Our endeavor in this class is to eventually get to the 27 books of the New Testament and to try to cover them, not in any kind of detail, obviously, but to try to give an overview of those books and to try to give an overview of those books and how they fit into the whole of the New Testament system. Is there anybody who does not have a new handout for this week? Brad and Ivan were the ones passing those out, and that was last week's. Did you get one for this week? Hey, Brad. We need some new. Oh, here's Ivan. We need a few new ones up here. Brad has last week's. He'll bring that. If you need last week's, keep your hand up. There is obviously more material in these handouts than we could ever try to cover, even in a number of classes. And so the design of these handouts is not for us to go over them point by point. We will try to cover some of the highlights of these handouts, but these are intended for you to take home and to review and to study and hopefully to benefit you in your study of the New Testament. Here's where we started last week, and here's where your handouts start. Basically, on page 5 of your handout from last week, we skipped over the first 4 pages. But if you start on page 5 of your handout from last week, what we tried to do is to set the political setting. What was happening politically during that first century and in the years leading up to it, so that we know when Jesus comes on the scene, when the church is established, what's happening in the world, so that we can know how it's impacting Jesus, his ministry, and the growth of the New Testament church. We talked about the fact that the Roman Empire was the ruling empire of the day. There had been the Babylonians, the Medo-Persians, and the Greeks, but now the Roman Empire, the great mighty Romans, were the leading force in the world. And this is a list of many of the not all of them, but many of their of the emperors. These are a list of their Caesars. Caesar is not just a decent salad dressing. It is the name of the Roman emperors. Sometimes we think of Caesar and we think that has to be a specific man. Well, all of these were Caesars. And so we need to think about Caesar being more of a title, in the same way that when we get to these Herods and we're talking about the Herods, we recognize that as a title rather than simply as a name that we may think of it. So think about the Roman Empire, and here's how we tried to describe it last week. You think about the United States, and over the United States we have a president who has authority over all of the states. But then in each individual state, there's a governor who has authority over that state, but not anywhere outside of that state. And then within each state, you have the counties, you have the cities, and you'll have individual governments and mayors and leaders over those particular cities and areas. Well, Roman government was much like that. You have the emperor, you have the Caesar, who has authority over all of the land. And then in the individual provinces, that Rome would come and conquer and add to their number, they would set up, the emperor would set up either a proconsul or a procurator over that particular province. And for the word procurator, you might just think about the word governor, or that's a word we understand. In fact, you have on the bottom of page 5 some of the more notable procurators during Bible times, and you know that these men were called, or some translations have them called, governors. And so you can think about that word. They're over a particular region. I doubt you can see this much at all. I tried to throw a map in here. Last week we tried talking about using a Bible map, and you may want to look in the back of your Bible at your maps to try to get a sense of the region that we're talking about. These procurators would have been over the Palestine, the whole area of Palestine. If you come up here to this, you probably can't read that, but that says Caesarea right there. Caesarea was a city on the coast. And that was the headquarters. That's where the procurator lived. When he was at home in his palace, that's where he would have been staying. And he would have been the procurator, the governor over that entire region. But there were times when maybe those procurators were not in place, that there were some more localized officials, and they are called kings. These Herods were often called kings. If you look on page 8 of your handout, you have a diagram that looks, is it page 8? I don't remember if that's the right number. You have a diagram that sort of looks like what's on the screen. It's helpful for us to understand that, again, you have the emperors over the entire empire. You have the procurators, the governors over a particular region, province. And then you may have sometimes within that province other local leaders. Now, the emperor would put a procurator in place who was of Roman origin, but sometimes in these localized areas, they used local leaders. And so the Herods were not some Roman transplant brought over and dropped in having no knowledge of the area. Herod the Great was from this area of Idumea right down here in southern Palestine. And so that he was of Jewish origin. He would have understood Jewish customs, Jewish practices. He would have understood the Jewish religion in a large portion. And so when you go and you look at these Herods, and I hope this chart is helpful to us. We reviewed this a little bit last week. Herod the Great is at the top. Herod the Great is the one that we know of in Matthew chapter 2, who tried to kill baby Jesus by having all of the infants 2 years old and under slaughtered. Great man, right? That was his M.O. He wanted to kill all sorts of people, killed his own sons if he thought they were trying to take his throne, killed his own wife when he suspected her that she had been unfaithful. He was a paranoid guy in his later years, and was very well known for slaughtering and killing folks. So that's Herod, and he's called Herod the Great. He was responsible. He was responsible. I don't know that we'll get there tonight. Hopefully we will. He was responsible for rebuilding the temple that was in Jerusalem. When you think about the temple in Jerusalem, who built, if we were to go all the way back to our Old Testament history, who built the temple? Solomon did. Is that the temple that was standing there when Jesus arrived on the scene? It's not the same temple. You know, sometimes we read Solomon built the temple, and then we turn to our New Testament and we read that Jesus is there at the temple. Same thing, right? Yeah, no. Yes and no. Is it the temple? Yes. Is it the temple in Jerusalem? Yes. Is it where the temple where the Jews gathered for their religious festivities? Yes. Was it the same actual stone building? No, that had been destroyed. Solomon's temple had been destroyed when the Babylonians came into town and carried them off to captivity. When Zerubbabel, after the decree of Cyrus, freed the Jews, Zerubbabel brought that first band of Jews back. They began rebuilding that temple. And through the efforts of Haggai and Zechariah, you know those two Old Testament prophets, they finally completed that temple. But then during that intertestamental period, those 400 years between the Old Testament and the New Testament, the temple is again desecrated. Antiochus Epiphanes comes through and just desecrates the temple. He offers, of all of the things to do, he offers a pig on the altar there at the temple. You think he did that on purpose? You think that was accidental? Here was a very vile man, and we'll try to talk more about that in a minute. But anyway, Herod the Great comes along. That's how we got off on that little subject. Herod the Great comes along, and after he conquers and takes possession of Jerusalem and Judea, this southern region down here, after Herod the Great takes possession of this and is named the King of the Jews, he rebuilds and beautifies and really expands the temple in Jerusalem. And so, as wicked and vile of a man that he was, Here was something decent that he did. And he didn't do that for the Jews, obviously. He did it for his own glory. He did a lot of building around that area. Anyway, he had a number of children. And on your handout there are listed five of his children. We talked about a few of them last week. We talked about Herod Philip the First. You'll also notice over here that by another wife, he had another son named Herod, who we might get confused because this Herod Philip is also mentioned in Luke 3, but it's different than this Philip over in Mark chapter 6. So it's helpful, I think, to divide this out and say, okay, who are these children? Who are these sons? Herod Philip the First was married to his niece, we noticed last week, was married to Herodias, who happened to be also his niece, the daughter of Aristobulus. We noticed also last week that Herod Antipas was the Herod before whom John the Baptist had been brought, and Herod Antipas was responsible for beheading John the Baptist at the request of Herodias. Why did Herodias want John the Baptist's head? Why did she want him dead? That's not very nice. Here's John the Baptist telling Herod Antipas, you have no lawful right to have Herodias as your wife. And he kept on saying it till finally Herodias got her way and had John the Baptist beheaded. But that's not the only thing we know about this Herod. This is the same Herod, Herod Antipas, the same guy who beheaded John the Baptist, is the same Herod that Jesus appeared before when he was on trial, before he was crucified. You remember that when Jesus was arrested in the Garden of Gethsemane, he was first brought, who was he first brought before to be put on trial? He's first brought before a Jewish court. He's first brought before a Jewish high priest. He's first brought before Annas and Caiaphas. But they did not have, nor did the Sanhedrin, the Jewish Supreme Court, have at that time the lawful right to for capital punishment, to put someone to death. And so they are the ones who took Jesus to Pilate. Now remember who Pilate was. Pilate is the governor. Pilate's the governor, the procurator over this entire region. When Pilate heard that Herod was in town, you remember that part of the story about Jesus' trials? When he heard that Herod was in town, Pilate sent Jesus over to Herod, hoping Herod would deal with him and take care of the trial. And of course, when Herod saw Jesus, he was excited. He wanted to see some kind of miracle. He had been hearing about Jesus. Jesus was not going to oblige, didn't even speak while he's before Herod. And so Herod sends him back. But the reason that he was sent before Herod is when you read about Pilate, he heard that Herod was in town and that Jesus was from his region. Good. Let this guy deal with him instead of me. And so that's Herod Antipas. When you keep looking at his children, you've got Herod Archelaus, who is briefly mentioned in Matthew chapter 2. This was the son that Joseph and Mary feared when they came back from Egypt. They thought that he might try to kill baby Jesus as well. And so that's why they went and settled. We noted, if you look on page 6 of your handout, where it talks about Herod Archelaus. Where was Herod Archelaus, the tetrarch? What region was he over? Herod Archelaus was the king, the tetrarch, over this southern section right down here. When Herod the Great died, Herod the Great was the king over this entire area, more or less. When Herod the Great died, his land was divided among his sons. Now, Aristobulus did not get any of that land, but Herod Archelaus got this land right here. He got the prime real estate of the land. Herod Antipas got this region right up here. Now, where was Jesus from? You ever heard of a city that starts with N and sounds like Azareth? Yeah, that city. So when Pilate heard that Herod Antipas was in town, Herod Antipas had this little blue region right up here. He had Galilee as well as Perea. But he heard that Jesus was from Nazareth. That's Herod's section. We'll send him over to Herod. Now, here's Philip. Herod Philip's region up here. Now, what's the point? Point is, you look at these sons, and when Joseph and Mary come back from Egypt, they fear Archelaus. He's got this region. So where do they go and settle? They go and settle up in Nazareth, which is out of Archelaus's reach. Now, you come down, and we don't know anything about Aristobulus from the Bible, but we do know his son named Herod Agrippa. Now, don't let all of these Herods confuse you. They're all called Herod. But we know about his son, Herod Agrippa. In Acts chapter 12, the very first verse of Acts chapter 12 talks about Herod Agrippa and says that he had stretched out his hand in order to harass some from the church. Acts 12 and verse 1. When you read about Herod doing that, look in your Bibles in Acts chapter 12. And if you're just reading along in Acts chapter 12, this will be the first time as you're reading the book of Acts that you come to this name, Herod. Acts chapter 12, verse 1. And for about that time, Herod the king stretched out his hand. Herod who? Is it Herod the Great who tried to kill baby Jesus? Nope, he's dead. Is it Herod Antipas who killed John the Baptist and before whom Jesus stood? Nope, it's not that Herod. Well, what Herod is it? If you're just reading the Bible, you just come across Herod and Herod and Herod. Well, which Herod? Which Herod is it in Acts chapter 12? It's Herod, the son of Aristobulus. It's the Herod who killed the first apostle named James in verse 2. Same Herod who threw Peter into prison. Verses 3 and 4. No doubt intending to do the same thing to him. It's the same Herod who at the end of chapter 12 sat upon his throne all arrayed in his glory. He allowed the crowd to call him a god. You look in Acts chapter 12 and verse 22. The people started shouting about Herod Agrippa. The voice of a god and not of a man. And did Agrippa stop them and say that's not right? No, he gloried in it. Well, what happened to him? He was eaten by worms and died. Does your Bible say that he died and then he was eaten by worms? Is that it? What order does verse 23 indicate? Immediately an angel of the Lord struck him because he did not give glory to God. And he was eaten by worms. And died. Isn't it usually the other way around? I mean, I'm just guessing. But isn't it usually the other way around? Apparently it wasn't the other way around. For Herod Antipas. But every time I read this story, I always think of Grant Fuller. When we had a family Bible Bowl a lot of years ago. Grant, you all know Grant, right? When Grant Fuller was like that. Grant was probably 3 or 4 or 5 years old. I don't remember. He was very young. It was a family Bible Bowl, so the whole family was involved. Grant didn't know many answers. We were doing the book of Acts, I guess, for the family Bible Bowl, and he didn't know a whole lot of answers to the Bible questions. He knew this one. When we asked the question, what happened to Herod? This little boy, wouldn't you know, a little boy, 4 or 5 years old, knows the answer. This little 5-year-old, he was eaten by worms and died. Yeah. Well, who is that? He's the man who allowed himself to be set up above all of the others and appear even as a god himself. Come back one more time to this chart and we're going to finish this up. That's Herod Agrippa the First. We know his children, or at least we know 3 of his children. Herod Agrippa the Second. It's interesting. I don't know how much of this you want to know. Herod Herod Agrippa I was the first one to regain control or authority over this entire region. Remember what we said about Herod the Great? When Herod the Great died, the land was divided among his sons. Now, what happened when his sons died? When his sons died, all of this land that was divided when Herod the Great died, when the sons died, all of the land eventually came back under the rule of Herod Agrippa I. But when he died, his son was only 17 years old. And apparently, you know, Josiah was 8, and that was good enough. But that wasn't during the days of Rome. And for Rome, a 17-year-old was not old enough to handle the throne. And so they took the land again from Herod Agrippa I and divided it. And so when you read about Herod Agrippa II, the son of Agrippa I, he didn't have as much authority, didn't have as much reign. But where do we read about him? Paul's on trial. Remember what happened to Paul at the end of his third missionary journey? Paul finished his third missionary journey in the city of Jerusalem, where he was arrested, where he was bound, where he was kept for a time until there was such an uprising that they snuck him out of town at night. And they carried him away to, you remember where they carried him away to? They carried him away to Caesarea. Why did they take him to Caesarea? Because that was the headquarters of the procurator. So they took him to the main place where he's going to be able to stand on trial. And he gets over there and he's put on trial before Felix. You remember what Felix said? Felix's famous line in the Bible. I think I'm going to wait for a more convenient season. There's Felix for you. You know, if you wait for a more convenient season, does that season usually roll around? When you've heard the gospel and it's been taught to you, isn't that a pretty convenient season to do something about it? And you put it off and you put it off, and that season's likely not going to come back, and we have no evidence it ever did. So Felix stuck Paul in prison. And since he was such a coward to do anything about it, Paul was stuck in prison in Caesarea for 2 years until Festus, the next procurator. Remember the procurators, they've got authority over this entire region. Festus comes to the throne. Festus learns about Paul's case. And Festus is trying to figure out, what do I do about Paul? I mean, this guy, you know, he's been brought here by the Jews. They've made accusation against him. What do I do about him? So Festus brings Paul out. Paul makes his defense before Festus. Paul appeals to Caesar before Festus. As a Roman citizen, if you appealed to Caesar, what other option did Festus have than to send him to Caesar? That's the law. But Festus had a problem. All right, I'm going to send him to Caesar. What am I going to tell Caesar? Here's Paul. He's innocent. He's never done anything wrong. I'm sending him to you because, And so Agrippa II comes to town in Caesarea, probably to congratulate Festus on his new position as the procurator. And so when Agrippa II comes to town with his girlfriend, a.k.a. sister, that's back on this chart. Here's Agrippa II, and he comes with Bernice, his companion, girlfriend, sister. They come to town. Half sister, probably. I don't remember the names of the mothers here, but likely a half sister. If you go up and look at some of the names of the mothers up here, you will notice that Herod the Great apparently liked the name Mariam, if that's how you pronounce it, because he had a first wife named that, and he had a second wife named that. And I believe that even, it may have been Herod Agrippa, one of his sons or grandsons had a woman wife by the same name. Anyway, What are we talking about? Herod Agrippa II and Bernice and Festus throw a big party. They throw a big celebration, and they bring Paul in to make his defense. Now, as he goes through that defense in Acts chapter 26, Paul says to King Agrippa, "Do you believe the prophets? I know you believe the prophets." Now, when we read that, we think he's the king. What would he know about the prophets? He's the king. What would he ever know about Judaism? Yes, he's the procurator, the governor, the king, but look at his family history. Agrippa is of Jewish origin, Jewish background. He is a Jew. He would have been taught the prophets. He would have known the prophets. And so it was not out of line for Paul to say in Acts 26, "I know you believe the prophets." What was Agrippa's famous line? Almost. If you had kept on, you might have done it. Almost you persuade me to become a Christian. Well, is that good enough? Is waiting for a more convenient season good enough? No. Is being almost persuaded good enough? No, that's not good enough either. So hopefully we can try to put some of these leaders in their context. Who they were, where they had authority, and all of that. Here's one more thing I want us to see about this political setting. In Galatians chapter 4, in verse 4, I don't have this on the screen, and I don't know if I had it in your handout, I probably don't. In Galatians chapter 4 and verse 4, it talks about the timing of the coming of Jesus. It talks about the timing in which Jesus came to this world, and obviously the timing in which the church was going to be established, and the timing in which Christianity was going to be set up and grow. Galatians 4 and verse 4 says, "But when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth His Son, born of a woman, born under the law." What does that mean, when the fullness of time had come? Is time ever not full? Okay, there were certain things that had been fulfilled scripturally that made it the right time. What does it mean that it was when the fullness of time had come? Okay, prophecies were lined up. Prophecies were ready to be fulfilled. Was there anything about, and what we're looking at on your handouts, was there anything about the political setting, the economic setting, the religious setting? Was there anything about, not just biblically speaking, but worldwide speaking? Was there anything that was just about ready and perfect to make this the opportune time for Jesus to come? We're going to notice more as we go through this, but the two, I thought there were more than two here, aren't there? There are four, right? The four that are listed here for you. As massive as the Roman Empire was, and as much as they ruled with an iron fist in many places and in many ways, there was a political unity that permeated the entire empire. And everyone within the empire had to fall in line behind that political unity. Now, if the world had been in political chaos, would that have been a ripe time for Christianity to come on the scene? If everything's in chaos, if you go from one place to another place and you never know what kind of laws you're going to run into. But when you live in a world empire that has created a unity about it, not just a unity politically, but we talked last week about the Pax Romana, the Roman peace. There was a peace that had been secured throughout Rome. Did that make it the perfect time for Christianity to come? When we are, how far are we removed? 2,000 years from the Roman Empire, And at least when I was in history class, we were still learning about the Pax Romana. I don't know what they're learning about in history class today, okay? But when we were in school, they were teaching about it. Why are we learning about that piece 2,000 years removed from it? Because it was pretty significant. Would that make it a good time? For Christ to come, for Him to establish a religion that needed to be taught? Christianity is a taught religion that needed to be taught and spread. What about a law that was uniformly enforced, or at least to the best of their ability done so, that brought stability and consistency to that land? What about the protection that Roman citizens had? Would this be a good time to try to teach the gospel as a Roman citizen? Didn't Paul prove that to be the case? So politically speaking, if you tie Galatians 4 verse 4, and politically speaking, here are four things, and there's a little bit more information on your hand about those. But this was no doubt the perfect time. Let me zip through this, because this is less interesting to me. What about the social and economic setting? What was happening in the world socially and economically? This is on what, page 9? I don't remember the page number. Page 9 of your handout. I don't even know that I've got many blanks. A couple blanks there. The social classes that existed then are much like they would exist in any other time. But especially in the Roman Empire, the division between the wealthy and the poor was very stark. In fact, it is estimated that the majority... The majority of the inhabitants of the Roman Empire were slaves. But you think about that. You think about the social conditions of the world into which Christ came. And in the Roman Empire as a whole, most of the people were slaves. But it's interesting that within Palestine, within the Jewish circles, it was not that stark. The division between the wealthy and the poor was not that great. It was there, but not as much as it was in the empire. And slavery was not as common. Why do you think that would be? Why do you think slavery wasn't as common among the Jews as it was everywhere else in the empire? They'd been there, done that. Don't want to be on either side of that again. Is there anything about a relationship with the Almighty God that will do away with slavery? Did slavery exist in the first century? Yes. But it's interesting that when you read about Paul encountering slaves and writing about slaves and writing about masters and slaves, most of the time that involved the Gentile world. And not so much the Jewish world that he had been in. What was the relationship like between Jews and Gentiles? Was that pretty good? Did they get along? No. Do you remember when they put Jesus on trial and they took him to Pilate at the Praetorium? They wouldn't even go inside. Why wouldn't they go inside? When they took him to stand before Pilate, why would these Jews not have anything to do with where Pilate was? Why would they not have anything to do with this system that was there? There was a line between the Jews and Gentiles that the Jews were not willing to cross. They didn't have anything nice to say about the Gentiles. You think the Gentiles had much nice to say about the Jews? No. And so when Ephesians 2 talks about Jesus breaking down the middle wall of separation, what's that talking about? Some people think it's talking about the literal wall. There was a literal wall at the temple compound. Around the temple in Jerusalem, there was a court called the Court of the Gentiles. Gentiles could get that close to the temple. But then, there was a sign at the next entrance. No Gentile scum beyond this point, or something in that vernacular. But there was a definite wall that separated the Gentiles from the Jews. Some think that's what Ephesians 2 is talking about. I don't think it's talking about some literal wall. It's talking about that wall that had divided these two entities. Now, what does Ephesians chapter 2 teach? It teaches that when Jesus broke down that middle wall of separation, that He took the Jew and He took the Gentile and He brought them together and made one. He reconciled them together in one body through the cross. Ephesians 2, 14, 15, and 16. When Jesus died on the cross, did He die for Jews or Gentiles? Yep, He died for them all. And so He said, we're not going to have this division between us. We're going to remove that so that we can all be one in Christ. You think that was easy? Jews and Gentiles to be in the same congregation? If you were a Jew or a Gentile and one of the other ones got up to lead a prayer during the assembly, oh no, I don't know if I can pray with him. They had some serious baggage to overcome. What about the Jews and the Samaritans? They have some serious baggage? Yeah. They wouldn't even talk to each other. They wouldn't. You know the Jewish travel route. If we can go back to that, we go back to that map. We've noted this a number of times. Boy, that's too far back, wasn't it? I didn't realize it was that far back. Here's Samaria. Guess where the Samaritans lived? Yep, Samaria. Good guess. So here's where they lived. You got Jews living up here in Galilee. Remember, that's where Jesus was raised in Nazareth. You have Jews living down here in Judea. But when they got ready to travel back and forth, I mean, if you're traveling on foot, isn't, you know, point A to point B about the way that you would normally take it? And if you can cut it even shorter than that, if you're traveling by foot, you're going to do it. No, not the Jews. We're not going to have anything to do with the Samaritans. So we're going to come down here, cross the Jordan River, come down south, cross the Jordan River, come back over here. Why? Because the Jews don't have anything to do with the Samaritans. Did it throw the disciples off when they came back and found Jesus sitting at a well talking to a Samaritan who was a woman? Threw them off, didn't it? Why? Because Jesus was trying to teach an object lesson. We're not going to have this anymore. We're not going to have this division anymore. But when Jesus came on the scene, that was definitely the setting. The social setting into which he came. One other thing. Let's not talk about that. I'm going to talk about that a little later on. What about the economic setting? I'm not going to mention any of this. You got on page 10 some of the occupations. Obviously, they were big farmers and they were big fishermen. And I think what's helpful to you is maybe this currency. What would you call it? Some kind of a currency equivalency here. When you're reading through the Bible and you come across, or you're reading through the New Testament, you come across a certain coinage. You know, how much was that really worth? And there's a little information there about the coinage, but we won't talk about that as a part of this. If you were to look at this idea of Galatians 4 and verse 4, that Jesus came when the fullness of time had come. Jesus came at the exact right time that the world was ripe for Christianity. You have to look at the universal language. What was the universal language? It was Greek. The Romans spoke Greek. Well, why didn't they speak Roman?
They eventually did.
Who was the world empire before the Romans?
Greek.
The Greeks. Who was the most well-known Greek? Alexander the Great. What did Alexander the Great do? What did he accomplish?
Conquered the world.
And when you conquer the world, what did Alexander the Great want? Everybody to speak the same language. And so the Greek language, through that effort and continuing efforts, the Greek language began to permeate all of the world. Now, Latin existed, but Latin was only spoken in small circles. Latin was spoken in the courts, would have been spoken by the lawyers and in some circles, but it was not prevalent. Hebrew at that time was basically a dead language. The Jewish rabbis spoke it, but there weren't many others who knew Hebrew. Now, Aramaic, which was kind of a branch of Hebrew, Aramaic would have been more prevalent. Some of what Jesus spoke would have been in Aramaic, as best as we understand it. So it was used somewhat, but the dominant universal language was Greek. And the Greek, the language that it was Koine Greek, or the word means common. It was a common, ordinary Greek language that everyone spoke. Well, would that help the gospel to spread? I mean, if Paul could travel from Jerusalem to Antioch to Europe and get into Philippi and get over to Italy and speak in Rome, and if he could speak the same language everywhere he went, he didn't have to have a translator. He didn't have to go immerse himself in a culture and learn a new language. If he could speak the same language everywhere he went, would that have any benefit to it? Yeah. And when the Bible was translated, back in 250 B.C., the Old Testament in Hebrew was translated into the Greek language. So when they were going around quoting from the Old Testament scriptures, they were able to quote in the common language of the people. And then the other thing that just made it so easy was the travel. Roman roads have been historically known for how good they were. And not the quality of the roads, but how much they spread throughout the empire. If you wanted to get somewhere, there was a road that went there. Of course, we say all roads lead to Rome, but that was because the emperors wanted the armies to be able to get wherever the armies needed to get. We'll put in roads so they can get there. We want commerce, we want trade to be able to get wherever it needs to get. And so travel, whether it be by road or by sea, was something that was very easy for them to accomplish. Would that be a good time for the gospel to be spread? Would that be a good time for Christianity to come into the world, to be able to be spread through these easy means of language and travel and a universal law and all of these things we've talked about? What we're going to do next week, we are going to briefly look at this second set of handouts that I gave you tonight. It would be good if you want to take them home tonight and look through them. But it's basically talking about the religious setting of the day and particularly looking at the Jewish element that was there and present and how that impacted the spreading of the gospel when it was coming in. What we're going to do next week, we'll briefly look at that, and then we're going to get into the Gospels and try to see what we can do with the book of Matthew next week.